Hello and welcome to Patron Deities, a show about deities for my patrons. I'm James Holloway, and I'm taking a look at the myths and religions of the world and looking for inspiration in them for fantasy role-playing games. In today's episode, we are continuing our series on Tengrism, the religion of medieval Central Asia, but we're kind of taking a little swerve out of mythology for a moment and into history, or at least looking at a place where history and mythology overlap. In previous episodes, we have talked about the way that Tengrism, that is the belief in Tengri, the god of heaven, the sky god, is associated with ruling dynasties and with validating their authority, much in the same way as supreme deities in many of the other faiths we've looked at on this podcast endorse or authorize the rule of kings or what have you. In fact, one of the earliest pieces of writing that we have that relates to Tengri in a Turkic language, the Orkhon inscriptions, are about glorifying these rulers, and that's kind of the role that Tengri plays in that, that they rule at Tengri's behest, you know, Tengri has, you know, it's the will of Tengri that these people are in charge, etc., etc. There's nothing necessarily unique to Tengrism in that, and there isn't anything necessarily unique in Tengrism's approach to adopting great rulers as figures within the religion. You can see, for example, the way that monarchs or people related to the royal family often become saints in early medieval Europe, whether that's Saint Olaf in Norway, Saint Edward in England, Saint Edmund in England, St. Oswald in England. We got a lot of royal saints, is all I'm saying. St. Louis in France, etc., etc. But today's example is exceptional, largely because of how exceptional the ruler was. If you look at someone like, you know, St. Oswald, St. Oswald is important to Northumbrians and, a lesser extent, Mercians. He's not even a particularly important saint in all of England. But we're going to be looking today at an example of someone who's been adopted by the Tengrist faith, who plays an important role in the history and thus in the sort of sense of national identity of a range of different cultures because of the vast scale of this person's historical influence. I'm talking, of course, about Genghis Khan. Now, if Tengri is the one who ordains rulers, then it follows that he would have had something to do with the greatest ruler, the universal ruler, the Genghis Khan. So, a brief historical background. The man who would later become known as Genghis Khan, he was known as Temujin during his young life. He was born in the 12th century. We're not sure exactly when, but one commonly given date is 1162. He was the son of a Mongol noble, but following his father's death, his family fell from power. Not to go into too much detail, but he had a pretty tough early life, including a period where he was enslaved. In the 1180s and 1190s, having gained back some of his family's power, he went through a long process of uniting individual tribes and groups into a confederacy. And in the process, he had some exciting rivalries and daring adventures, which you can read all about in The Secret History of the Mongols. I'm not going to go into it here, partly because it would take too long, but also partly because I don't necessarily want to focus on the facts of Genghis Khan's life from a gaming perspective for reasons that I'll explain a little bit later on. So by the end of that period of unification, by 1206, Genghis had unified a variety of different tribes and tribal confederacies into what we might think of today as the Mongols, even though I don't necessarily know that every group within that confederacy would have spoken Mongolian. In fact, I'm pretty sure some of them didn't, and would have thought of themselves as Mongols, but they all owed allegiance to the Khagan, the Great Khan. So Genghis organized and regulated these groups, did all those culture, hero, legendary king things, established a legal code, appointed officials, etc., etc., and then embarked on a series of conquests that would occupy the next 20 years, and that would see Mongol influence spread from the border of Korea to the Caspian Sea. A lot of that was going on in the kingdoms that bordered northern China, or indeed controlled northern China, because at this point, the kind of center of Chinese power is not in the north. So, you know, one of the cities that Genghis captures is the city that is today Beijing, but at that time, it is not even really thought of as being part of China. It's ruled by the Jin dynasty, who, if you've read, say, The Legend of the Condor Heroes, they're the bad guys. It's the Sung who are seen as Chinese, but they're located further south than that. But there's a lot of different, you know, states and kingdoms up here in the north of China and north of China, and Genghis eventually conquers them all and then moves west. By the time he died in 1227, he had amassed a pretty sizable empire, and he left it to his third son, Ogedai. Hey, so a little sidebar here. Third son, you say? Well, Genghis had chosen as his heir his first son, although, in fact, his first son's parentage was somewhat disputed. Genghis seems to have loved his wife, or at least that's what the histories say, even though it's not like they were a love match. They were engaged to be married when they were both children. And in terms of the birth of his first son, you know, I think there's some speculation that, like, the timeline kind of doesn't add up and he may, in fact, be someone else's child. But Genghis does not seem to have let this trouble him. And he, you know, treated his wife's firstborn child as his firstborn child and didn't bring up the issue. But, you know, who did bring up the issue was, predictably, his second son, who objected to his elder brother being the heir when he potentially might not be one of Genghis's children. And for this, Genghis excluded him from the succession anyway, such that when his eldest son died, the throne passed to the third son. But the reason I mention this is purely as a sidebar for the 40k fans, or the 30k fans, I guess, in my audience, because that second son is Jagatai. That's where that name comes from, although they're spelled differently. Anyway, it's not the events of Genghis Khan's life that we're really interested in. It's his legacy and the way that he has become this powerful image that affected a wide range of cultures in future generations. So he obviously, you know, is seen as this unifier of Mongols and related tribes, but also as the founder of the Yuan dynasty, you know, which is the Chinese ruling dynasty that would be governed by his heirs. Kublai Khan, probably the most famous. But the point is that he's regarded as a founding father and a crucial figure in a number of different countries and cultures. This, by the way, has led to a little bit of competition over who gets to claim Genghis. So who gets to be regarded as the heir of his authority? Because there are lots of things that Genghis Khan can be a symbol of, but obviously one of them is like conquest and rule. So what does that mean to a nation that realistically, you know, is not in a position to be like engaging in an expansionist war of conquest? Does it mean something rather different when we're looking at it from the perspective of China? I went once to a lecture by Professor Uradin Bulag, I mean, a long time ago about this, and he was talking about the different ways in which people use the legacy of Genghis Khan to bolster certain senses of national identity. We'll talk about this in a moment. Now, I'm sure you've read one of those articles that said something about, you know, everyone's descended from Genghis Khan. And this is true for mathematical reasons to do with the way that population genetics works. And I, you know, I don't, given how many, you know, great, 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 whatever grandparents I have from the first quarter of the 13th century, I think, yes, I may be descended from Genghis Khan, but also not in any way that that's important at all. But I do think that it's interesting to think about Genghis Khan as a universal ancestor, because, of course, the ancestral spirit element of Tengrism is where he turns up. You know, we've seen that particularly significant individuals, such as community leaders or shamans, can manifest as spirits in the shamanic practices that kind of surround and embody Tengrism. And then, of course, he's an individual who had a particularly strong connection to Tengri. We've seen that, you know, heaven kind of put its thumb on the scales in order to have Genghis become ruler. Part of this, of course, is that both of these things have been seen as being expressions of like an authentic Mongolian culture. And everyone in the modern day can look back and see some aspect of Genghis's policies that they can say, ah, well, he was ahead of his time, I want that. And that's sort of true no matter where you are on the political spectrum, because maybe you're in favor of, I don't know, Mongolian nationalism, in which case Genghis is the one who united all Mongols and stopped them from unprofitably fighting each other. Or alternatively, maybe you're more of an internationalist, in which case Genghis was the ruler of an ethnically and culturally diverse empire who implemented policies of religious toleration. He regarded religious belief as an individual or community matter that didn't require any kind of state regulation. So he can be anything from an enlightened monarch running a multicultural society to a symbol of Pan-Asian unity to a symbol of Mongolian nationalism. And of course, in other parts of the world, he's remembered a little less fondly. And that commemoration can be very complicated. So, for example, there are a number of shrines in commemoration of Genghis Khan, although we do not know exactly where he is buried. Genghis was, for various reasons, quite cautious about turning his burial site into a location that could be fought over or one that could be seen as, you know, a transfer of authority. So the location of his burial was a carefully guarded secret. But one of these shrines to him has come to be regarded as kind of like the main shrine to Genghis, not without a little help from the authorities. And what's interesting about it is that it's not in Mongolia, the country. It's not in outer Mongolia. It's in inner Mongolia, that is, the Mongolia that is part of the People's Republic of China. So there was an existing shrine on the site. There was one then, like a more modern one, I guess, built by the Chinese government in the 1950s. It was subsequently destroyed in the Cultural Revolution and has been reopened. And like a lot of centers of religious veneration, it's something between a religious site and a historical museum and a tourist attraction. So the site has changed hands many times, but it's still a focus for shamanic rites dedicated to the Khan's spirit and also for competing claims to his legacy. So I mentioned earlier that I wasn't very interested in talking about the life of Genghis Khan. And the reason for that is that I think heroes of this type in a gaming context, heroes who have debatable legacies and who have profound influence, are more interesting when they are in the past. So I've said this before, but this is not a like full-throated recommendation of the Netflix TV series Marco Polo. But one of the really interesting things about the first season, this is less true in the second season, I think they only made two, but in the first season, Genghis is this shadow that hangs over his grandchildren. They are all kind of constantly being judged by whether they live up to the standards of Genghis, and they're all a little uncertain about what that actually means. Does it mean to be a warrior? Does it mean to be a conqueror? Does it mean to be a statesman? What is it to be the heir of Genghis Khan? And I think that that's always a really interesting question. He's a legacy that is impossible to escape. And you can do the same thing with any kind of deified hero. You get this a little bit in I, Claudius. I have read the novel, but it was so long ago. I'm mainly talking about the TV show. But definitely early on, I do think there is this idea that Augustus is someone who is a little unsure about where he stands, kind of in Julius's shadow. And then subsequently, you know, later emperors feel that same way about Augustus. Or as I mentioned frequently, I'm both listening to and reading the Romance of the Three Kingdoms right now, and you can see this with great heroes like Guan Yu and Zhang Fei, where their sons get a little time in the spotlight, but they never become as important characters as their fathers. And while that's for complex reasons, I'm sure, I do think that there's a little sense of like, well, what do you, like, your father is a god. You know, Guan Yu was deified. How can you compare to that? How can you live up to that example? Or how could the real forebear ever live up to that myth? Have you ever met someone great? I don't know that I have. I'm not sure they exist. Now, this is challenging in a role-playing game because people don't feel the same connection to... I'm trying to think who's a, you know, deceased hero of the past in a role-playing game setting, right? People don't feel the same way about Longinus in Vampire the Requiem. It's maybe a bad example because he's, of course, someone taken from an actual legend. But, you know, people don't feel the same way about Harmast Barefoot that they do about King Arthur or Guan Yu. But I think that there is something to the idea of having not background characters in the sense of like extras, but characters who exist in the game's background, whose legacy is contested and debatable in the game, which should be kind of how gods are treated as well, right? The reality is that religions are, you know, characterized by debates about what the deities want or what is the correct way to uphold their values or the correct way to worship them or whatever. And those debates, those uncertainties should be reflected in how the player characters respond to deities as well. This is not something that comes up very often in games, where often religious characters are portrayed not as people who have religion as part of their lives, but experience the same concerns about those parts of their lives that everyone does about everything, but as necessarily some kind of incurious fanatic. And then those debates can also tie into political questions, like with the Shrine of Jinx that I mentioned. You will hear people call that Shrine to Jinx a mausoleum, but it isn't. It has a coffin, but the coffin is empty because, as I mentioned earlier, no one knows where the Great Khan is buried. So we have competing factions laying claim to a legendary ruler's final resting place, both in terms of historical, like, changing hands of that particular site, but also in terms of competing claims about which of these shrines deserves to have primacy. And in addition to that, we've got the actual burial site, the location of which that historical figure went to great lengths to conceal. And I am hardly the first person to mention this. In fact, there's an episode of Ken and Robin Talk About Stuff. It's one of the Live from Dragon Meat ones. And I want to say that it's at the old venue, but I could be wrong. I mean, I realize there have been many old venues, but the previous one, not this one. Anyway, there is a section on the burial of Genghis Khan. And in fact, you can hear me on that episode asking a question about it. But so did Genghis Khan know that his focal point would be too powerful, that that location would have too much potential to cause division? Did he want to make sure that his legacy was seen as the legacy of the empire? That the focus for people's veneration would be not his tomb, but his son? I don't know. But I like the idea of having these historical characters being important, because if you look at the world around us, we tend to think of history often in the stories of, like, legendary founders, right? Of kings and queens, okay, World War II, great clash of nations. But we also see it as, like, oh, Roosevelt and Churchill and Hitler and Stalin kind of thing. People like a story with characters in it. And you have to be very careful, because I do think that when you create such a character, there's a temptation to, like, try and make everyone do a bunch of homework about who they are, and you run the risk of kind of Legend of the Five Ringsifying a game where it feels as though these NPCs are the real protagonists. But I do think that it's good to have these characters exist in the game world in its history, because they can be loci of debate. Whether that's people getting mad about commemorating someone, you know, you walk into the town where you're fellow party member is from, and there are all these statues of King Dirgelbergel, and you think, wow, you know, in my country, Dirgelbergel is known as a tyrant who oppressed our people, you know, I can't believe that you're celebrating him. And they're like, oh, well, around here, people think he's pretty great. And they have to deal with the fact that they never thought about it like that, right? Around here, people think Dirgelbergel's pretty great. You know, these historical figures can have different meanings, and they can easily be adopted into religious practice. I mean, you get this with saints, of course, right, in Christianity. So in Northern California, and I guess in Southern California too, in California, we got this guy, Father Junipero Serra, and I guess he's the blessed Father Junipero Serra. He's not a saint yet, or at least he wasn't last time I checked. And he was a missionary who was involved in, you know, the Spanish colonization of California and the conversion of the indigenous people to Christianity. You can kind of see where this is going. He did not become a saint at the time, and many people have advocated for Junipero Serra becoming a saint, but as far as I know, he never did, and it's easy to look at him and feel like he kind of missed his window, because when I was a kid, like, a guy came to our class who was a Junipero Serra reenactor, and he gave us a whole lecture on here's Junipero Serra, and, like, here's all the brave stuff he did. He traveled this many miles, and he was doing that, this, that, and the other, and this is all in, like, the 1770s, I think. And, wow, wasn't he a remarkable person? And I think today we would generally be a little more cautious about just handing the floor over to people who want to uncomplicatedly celebrate someone whose whole thing was the destruction of indigenous culture. And, you know, he did not happen to get made a saint, but there are some who did, who, you know, would have to have that same conversation about today. So I feel like there's an interesting possibility for debate as characters think about the historical legacies of their cultures and their faiths. I mean, it doesn't have to be a moral one like that. It could just be a historical figure who different cultures see in different lights. Whether that's seeing Genghis Khan as a hero of the Mongol people specifically, or like the unifier of the Silk Road. Now, I know that all the Gloranthophiles in the audience are waiting for me to talk about the hero who is seen this way in Glorantha. That's, of course, Arcot. There are many different versions of Arcot, like actually in the setting, there are these sort of multiple Arcots. And I always thought that this was a very funny way of thinking about how different cultures and different times view the same person in different ways. You know, there are lots of different Arcots. Here's Arcot, like, as a Humakti. Here's Arcot as a troll. Here's Arcot as a Malkioni knight. Some cultures Arcot's a hero, and some cultures he's a villain, etc., etc. Speaking of multiple presentations of a character, Genghis Khan also has something of a media footprint, although sort of not as much as you would think. The most infamous Genghis Khan movie is probably The Conqueror, in which John Wayne plays Genghis Khan. In my notes here, I've just written, oof, and that is about accurate. Just imagine doing a John Wayne accent and then saying, like, the most nonsense, cod medieval lines in that accent. So, what foolishness are you speaking, my mother? Or, take her to my tent. Yeah, my John Wayne's not very good. I was pretty proud of that, what foolishness he's speaking, but in general, it's not one that I excel at. But what really winds me up about this portrayal of Genghis Khan is that he's portrayed as a barbarian, right? The whole thing is a bit like, I think Al Leung plays Genghis Khan in Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure as like a greasy dude who just wants to eat chicken. It is extremely not cool. But in the John Wayne thing, the whole point is about, like, I fight, I conquer, I love like a barbarian. These kinds of, you know, barbarian movies were made with the idea of, like, ah, this is a primal people and they're gonna do primal stuff, which means we can get turned on by quasi-sexual assault behavior, but not really have to think about, well, not even quasi in that movie, but and not have to think about, you know, what if that happened to a real person? And this was a pretty common trait in Hollywood portrayals of certain types of cultures, right? Like, ah, they're a wild, free people. Maybe they're violent, but doesn't that mean they're really in touch with their primal natures? Which, Genghis Khan was a civilized and civilizing guy. Maybe a tyrant. A lot of conquering and despoiling, absolutely. But in a civilized way. Anyway, whatever. Quite apart from portraying a ridiculous stereotype that doesn't, like, even brush what Mongol culture was like, and changing the storyline in a way that actually makes it less exciting. So, like, of course, they get this whole kind of, like, John Wayne slaps whoever the lady is, Susan Hayward, until she loves him kind of thing going on. But, like, in real life, or at least in the sources, Temujin had to join forces with his estranged blood brother in order to get into an enemy camp and rescue his wife. So, like, he went on a daring mission to rescue a princess in real life. Tell me how that's not more cinematic than this creepy nonsense. Anyway, whatever. There's also one from the 60s where it's Omar Sharif. That one's a little bit better. And then there's a 21st century, I want to say like 2008 or so, film just called Mongol, starring Tadanobu Asano. If you don't know him, he's in the Thor movies. But anyway, that's pretty good. It's not, like, historically accurate per se, but it's got some cool moments, and at least it portrays Temujin, you know, in a more complex light. And definitely my favorite of the three. Though that Omar Sharif one's a weird sort of historic artifact. Anyway, whatever. My point is, this character can be seen from multiple perspectives. It's a balancing act, though. It's hard to give player characters... It's a balancing act, though. You might not want to give players the kind of homework required to, you know, mug up on some fictitious historical personage. And sometimes the easiest way to do that is just to say, well, this is kind of a King Arthur type, or I guess this is kind of a Genghis Khan type. All right, as we get toward the end of this season, I'm kind of thinking of doing a couple of compilation episodes where I talk about little topics that didn't really merit their own full episode. So, for example, talking about the relations between Tengrism and other religious traditions, or talking about the Epic of King Gesar, which is I'm probably mispronouncing that, but it's another kind of classic from this era that involves some Tengris content. So at this point, I don't know exactly what the makeup of our next episode is going to look like, but whatever it turns out being, I hope that you will join me then for Patron Deities, a show about deities for my patrons. Thank you for listening, and thank you very much for supporting Monster Man on Patreon.